This episode of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 15th of July 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly, episode 158, with me, Andrew Tuck, Jonathan Openshaw and Steve Bloomfield. This week, we'll be talking to no less than three authors about their books on three very different topics.
Frank Partnoy joins us to discuss the art of tactical procrastination in his book Wait, The Art of Science and Delay.
With the Olympics almost upon us, we'll be hearing how Britain invented almost every sport and then nearly lost them all with Julian Norwich, author of Can We Have Our Balls Back, Please?
And we'll be talking about the man who changed the face of an industry, overthrew governments and made millions by selling bananas. Rich Cohen joins us on the line to tell us about the extraordinary tale of Sam Zemuri in his book The Fish That Ate the Whale.
All that, a widescreen look at IMAX, plus a mix of the best music right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. So the balls and bananas are still to come. We're looking forward to that.
How long have you been planning that one?
I like a bit of alliteration in the morning. You know me. Don't mind a pun.
I thought you were going to say he'd like something completely different in the morning, but we'll move on from that.
Who doesn't? Well,
Steve. Now,
Different team.
Yep.
Now, you've had a few interesting guests through this building this week. I saw someone from Djibouti even was here.
Yes, the Djibouti finance minister was in Midori House a little earlier this week. He was very interesting. I liked him. We had a nice chat about cat.
Not a cat.
Cat spelled K-H-A-T or Q-A-T, depending on how you want to spell it or pronounce it. It's that leaf that you get in East Africa that you chew and chew and chew. And it's a little bit like, it's a drug. It's like light cocaine and legal. But natural. I'm describing it well, I think.
We'll be here, I'm sure. Has that already run, that little interview?
It did run. It ran on Midori House on Thursday.
Just tell me, for the people who didn't tune into your show, was he approving of it, that of Cat then, or is he?
We didn't get onto whether he actually chews it himself, okay. But he did say there was a bit of an issue about. But basically, everyone chews it in the afternoon and then does no work.
He didn't bring any in studio for you.
No, he described it though. He said it's a bit like your happy hour you have here.
A bit like that, but different. Because it's cocaine. Like,
well, and also we do tend to do happy hour after we finish work, not at lunchtime. Although in some offices.
And Jonathan, you've been looking at some legal highs as well, or legal bullets and legal bombs and legal all sorts of things. You've been at an arms fair.
Yes.
What kind of an arms fair?
I don't know. I don't know if there's anyone from Djibouti there, but there was certainly lots of Russian oligarchs and fairly dodgy looking sheikhs. But yes, I was out at Farnborough. So it's not actually an arms fair per se. It's the whole aerospace industry, but certainly a healthy element of arms were there on display. So I was looking at lots of missiles and UAVs or drones to the rest of us and the latest gadgets that were in the defence market.
Do you think you're the only reporter in the world who does catwalk reports and military and defence stories?
I did a radio check-in actually from Farnborough and Andrew Muller pointed out that it was fairly bizarre that last time I spoke to him I'd just left the Gucci show, and this time I was sitting outside the Augusta Westland Pavilion at Farnborough. But there you go, we cover it all here at Monocle.
That's the fun of being a proper business editor. You see, you can delve deep for the stories all around the world. Well, after the show, I'm going to Zurich.
Are you?
Yes.
On a jolly, isn't it?
No, it's not jolly.
We've got test out the quality of life.
We've got a good dose of Midoris and briefings coming live from Zurich on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. I'm going to be meeting Tyler Brulé, editor in chief, who's coming in from Asia this afternoon, and then I'm taking with me Fernando. And also Danny, who are going to be kind of like Team Zurich.
Team Zurich.
So I'm hoping, I am hoping the weather's nice, because it'd be good to check out the city.
I'm hoping the weather's not nice.
And it'd be very nice to be sitting in our Zurich office.
I
love our Zurich office. And we have Manon, our researcher there. So it's all going to be good. But anyway, more about that maybe later on. But certainly stay with us on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. There'll be lots to talk about. We're going to be talking to Frank Partnoy about his book Wait in just a moment.
It often seems that in business, as well as our personal lives, we're encouraged to listen to our heart. to go with our instincts, strike while the iron is hot, and so on. But our next guest has written a book in praise of taking time and the art of tactical procrastination. Professor Frank Partnoy is Professor of Law at San Diego University and one of the world's leading experts on the complexities of modern finance and market regulation. And in his new book, Wait, he argues for the merit of taking a deep breath and making a decision at the last possible moment for optimal results. Frank, welcome to the Monocle Weekly.
Thanks so much.
Can I start with a very, very obvious question? Did you take quite a while to think about coming up with this book?
Oh, it's such a painful, painful point for me. I've been, in some sense, writing this book my whole life and, of course, waited until the last minute. I actually got the cover. The cover has a golden retriever with a bone poised on its snout, showing how it can delay gratification. I got it in September of last year when I had finished about a third of the book, Procrastinating, even a book about procrastination.
And can I also ask you, can we just define what this really means? Because you're not talking about just long-term ponderous decisions, are you? You're talking about actually even quite quickly made decisions that there's a delaying mechanism where you can delay to the last second before you make your move. Can you just explain what procrastination is for us, if I can even say it?
That's exactly right. One of the things I wanted to explore in this book was how people use delay at various speeds. So the book starts out with very, very fast-paced decisions and reactions that are pre-conscious, things like a tennis player returning a serve or even a high-frequency trading algorithm run by a computer that's responding at the speed of light. And then it telescopes out to progressively longer and longer term decisions, eventually ending with the longest term decisions in our lives, the big policy questions like sustainability and climate change and valuing human life. And generally, procrastination is defined as needless delay. And one of the things I wanted to get away from in the book is the pejorative connotation that procrastination has taken on, particularly since the 1970s, when this kind of anti-procrastination industry emerged to make us all feel bad, to feel terribly guilty about procrastinating. There's been a lot of research recently that shows that there is a difference between good procrastination and bad procrastination. So my idea was to, instead of using this kind of loaded term, procrastination, to talk more about delay and where delay comes up in different parts of our personal and professional lives and when it's better to sort of grab delay by the horns and use it rather than having delay take advantage of you.
And you have a lot of case studies in your book, not all drawn from outside the world of business as well as from within. What are some of the examples that you use to really kind of illustrate your thinking on this one?
Well, we can start off with the very short term. So the book starts off with milliseconds long reactions. These are unconscious and begins with sport. So, for example, Wimbledon is going on now and people are watching tennis serves. It's remarkable how incredibly skilled these professional athletes are at returning serves at over 100 miles an hour, and they only have about 500 milliseconds to do so. And our initial reaction to watching those serves is that the reason the best professionals are better is that they're fast. But in fact, research by Peter McLeod at Oxford and others who study high-speed professional athletes shows that the reason they're so good is not because they're fast, it's because they're slow. It's very counterintuitive, but basically what they're doing is taking the 500 milliseconds that are available to them, and they're getting as fast as they can at their return at the end, so using up maybe only 50 milliseconds at the very end, so that they free up a lot of time before that to observe the speed and trajectory of the ball, to take in a lot of information during that earlier period. And one of the arguments I make in Wait is that that's a good metaphor for decisions in all of our lives at longer time frames. But it's pretty remarkable when you see professional athletes in slow motion. And according to McLeod, the difference between a really good professional and a really good amateur is only about 50 milliseconds.
And I was just going to ask you, your book kind of, it pitches into a bit of a debate, doesn't it really? Because we've already had Blink, which was the Malcolm Gladwell book, which was looking at the idea that you make decisions very fast and quickly. And there's obviously a whole library of books now about the slow movement and the idea of slowing down. Do you feel that you're taking, you are nudging into this kind of ongoing debate about the speed at which we make all sorts of decisions?
I think so. I think it's a fascinating debate, and it's been oversimplified in a way by people saying it's just about going really fast, and some people interpreted Malcolm Gladwell's book as being just about 2 seconds, that somehow 2 seconds is the optimal decision That was about 2 seconds, okay. Right? But the optimal pause, in fact, when we're speaking is often longer than that or shorter than that. And when we're looking at faces, for example, we can get a lot of information early on, but studies show that taking a longer period of time is often better. Taking a minute will give you a lot more information than 2 seconds. So one of the things I wanted to do is show a little bit of balance and show people that there are different ways to approach different decisions depending on the time frame, that basically there's a two-step process that people should follow and that successful CEOs and government leaders follow. And step one is to figure out what time world you're living in. Is this a decision, an email that has to be responded to in the next second or two? Or is it something that could last a week that you could put off for a while? Is it a one-month decision? That's step one. And then step two is, within that time period, delay as long as you possibly can, until it's painful. And just in speaking, you know, a pause after I've made a dramatic point, if it's a really good one, the longest possible pause might be an effective communication tool.
You say there's good procrastination and bad procrastination. As a journalist, I'm very, very familiar with bad procrastination, particularly when it comes up to deadlines. Is your argument really that, you can put off making the actual decision, but you still need to be thinking about that decision? It's not just about, I'm going to forget about this until the very last moment.
There is some work that should be going on, but it doesn't have to be conscious. So as a journalist, for example, if you had a deadline of 5 p.m. today, you could spend part of the time doing something else and your brain would still be working away at the problem.
Wait until the fear kicks in at 4:30.
Exactly. And the key is being in that two-step process. So how long does it take you to write the story? If you have to write 500 words for tomorrow, if you know that that will take you an hour, then you have until 4 o'clock. So if it's 3:30 and you have a choice between making a phone call to one last source to get another piece of information, you're sort of like a professional tennis player being able to delay until the last possible moment to get an extra nugget for your story.
I was going to ask you that you use these skills also when it comes to looking at the world of dating, and you go and visit a dating agency, and the woman who runs it says to you, actually, the key thing on a first date is don't make any judgments too quickly. You know, delay making any decisions. Certainly, at the end of the first date, all you should think about is whether you want a second date. Do you think it does really work in that way in personal relationships? Because most people seem to think that they have some kind of immediate gut instinct about someone they've met. It's the person for them. But do you think it is actually more of a decision-making process akin to being in business?
I do think so. And the pitch of It's Just Lunch, the International Dating Network, is exactly that, particularly for professionals who maybe have had a tattered record of snap responding to just seeing a photo or seeing someone in a bar, that's not always the ideal way to end up in a relationship, that having chemistry and compatibility are something that's learned over time, that you don't just get out of a photo. And one of the interesting things that It's Just Lunch does is for their first dates, they will not let their clients see photos as much as they might want them, because they think a photo is one of the most dangerous pieces of snap information that you can get. So they want people to go and live in this time world of 1 year. That's the one hour. Roughly lunch is the right amount of time for a first date. And then within that hour, process information, sometimes consciously, sometimes subconsciously, but force yourself to put off answering a basic question, would you like to see this person again, until the very end of the first date.
I wonder how much this is a message for the kind of economic times we live in, though, because, I mean, maybe for Steve, as a journalist with a very understanding editor like Andrew, then leaving your...
Understanding? Who started this horrible rumour?
Yeah. Leaving... That was irony. But leaving your copy till the last minute is one thing, but, I mean, if you're part of, say, you know, the technocratic government in Italy, or if you're in Greece or Spain, is it really the right message to be sending out, you know, leave things to the last minute, put things off to the last possible moment?
I do think so, actually. I think a lot of the problems that have been caused by snap reactions, by quick investment decisions, by quick regulatory overreactions. I'm certainly not suggesting that governments should be lazy or that people should be lazy in responding, but particularly now where we have this crush of technology and constant email and social media and 24-hour news, I think regulators in particular you're seeing now are snap reacting. They did this over the weekend of the Lehman collapse, and it's happening again, and it's happening particularly in the U.S. in this election cycle. We're not going to see a lot of meaningful debate going up into this election. And so I do think that although we have to be careful and not give governments excuses for inaction, that we would all be better off if people would take a breath and spend a little bit more time before they made their final judgments.
Because, Frank, I think it's interesting for us in the media industry. Monocle has been a deliberately slow brand. We've not thought you have to be the first person to do everything. And we've often watched and waited and seen how people have kind of unfurled their kind of media ambitions. And, for example, we don't have an iPad version, and we're keen to do one if it was right. But if it's not, we're not in a hurry to do it. And I think that for the media industry especially, you see so many newspapers that now, you know, they gave away all their free content because they rushed to the internet. They made an expensive iPad version that kind of corroded their paper business. And actually, I do think there is an example there even that, you know, it's good to sometimes not be part of the rush, to kind of step aside and let other people be the first. I think there's probably a good book to be done about why being second is best. Actually.
There actually is a tremendous amount of academic research that supports exactly what you've just said. And the metaphor that I like is that if there's a very dangerous cat there, it's going to get the first mouse and the second mouse gets the cheese. And that's what
and
happens.
I like cheese.
And I think the business model that you're talking about has a lot of wisdom in it, because it, even in technology, the first mover can have a disadvantage. There's actually a fair amount written in the academic world about the first mover disadvantage, that sometimes being first is not what you want to do.
Well, it's been a fascinating decision in the world of procrastination. Your book is called Wait, and it's going to be is it being released simultaneously around the world?
It is. It's been released in the U.S. It'll be released in the U.K. this week. I think it's available, so people shouldn't wait too long, maybe a few minutes.
But and one of those kind available. Of internet online book clubby kind of things might help to get it to you if you're in another part of the world. But Frank Portnoy, thank you very much for joining us. And we're now going to play you out with This Is Wait It Out by Imogen Heap.
Where do we go from here? How do we carry on? I can't get beyond the questions.
And that was Wait It Out by Imogen Heap. We'll be talking balls with author Julian Norridge next.
Wherever you're going this summer, and whether it's for work or play, let Monocle's editors be your travel companions. We've just refreshed and revised our team's guides to the world's top business cities and resorts, so you can have our 25/25 travel guide series in the palm of your hand with the Monocle app. Available from iTunes, or download free guides from monocle.com. From São Paulo to New York, Capri to St. Bart's, we can show you where to long lunch or go for your morning run. Just head to the iTunes App Store and download the Monocle app. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Welcome back to the Monocle Weekly, where, as Andrew promised, we'll be talking balls. These are puzzling times for sports lovers. On the one hand, there's an endless selection of high-definition choice for the couch-dwelling sports enthusiast. On the other hand, sports fans are constantly bemoaning the loss of their beloved game to the hands of broadcasters and global corporations.
In his new book, Can We Have Our Balls Back, Please? How the British Invented Sport and Then Almost Forgot How to Play It, Julian Norridge offers a very timely overview of how the British did indeed take the concept of physical competition and develop it into what we now know as the global sports industry. I sat down with, let's face it, the only other person in this building really interested in sport. That's our news editor, Tom Edwards, to talk about the origins of sport with Julian. Julian, welcome to the Monocle Weekly.
Thank you for having me.
It's quite all right. So a big summer of sport, particularly here in Britain, with the London Olympics starting later this month. Here in Britain, though, we're very good at inventing games, not so good at, or sports rather, not so good at actually competing once the rest of the world has caught up, are we?
That's exactly right. Now, we invented probably two-thirds of the major sports in the world, maybe even more, in the sense that we were the first people to actually lay down rules so that they could be played from between villages and villages, towns and towns, countries and countries in the end. And when we did that, first of all, we were very good at all of them and we dominated all of them. But then, as you said, the rest of the world began to catch up, and perfectly reasonably, we are now just another country. I think there are also some structural things in British sport which make it harder for us sometimes to succeed. And that has a lot to do with the way it's administrated, I think, which is still a very traditional sort of public school-based form of administration in many sports, not all.
And does that also lead to a sense amongst amongst fans, amongst sports watchers, to a feeling that we should be better than this, that we don't accept that we're a middle-ranking nation when it comes to football, or just not very good internationally when it comes to tennis? We think, we started this, we should be bloody good at it.
I think we all feel that, but we're all also realists and people who follow sports are sports fans, and we just know that we aren't as good at tennis as other countries are, other people are. Again, it may have something to do with the structure. That may change as the structure changes. But it has been a traditional thing. If you go back over in history, when it was first suggested that there should be a Soccer World Cup, for instance, the English said, no, there's absolutely no point in our taking part in that, because we'd have to play against these... an FA official actually called them minnows. He said, we have to play against these minnows like Russia and Brazil, and how can we expect a country like Wales to play against Brazil? It wouldn't be fair.
And then
on the Brazilians.
Yes, and then we eventually did, and we lost to America.
It took us about 20 years before we actually took part in the World Cup, and then we lost to America, yeah.
I mean, I just wonder, we talk about that sort of heritage of sports and the codification of them. Is it, do you think, a legacy of the sort of empire building that Britain is so well versed at establishing all these codes of conduct and practice, so many based on an honour code, and when it comes to actually delivering on the field of play, the wheels come off somewhat?
I think the start of sport was really before the start of empire, so it didn't have a lot to do with empire. That the empire helped to spread sport that we had codified. And it wasn't actually to do with honour very much either. We began to codify sport for one very simple reason, and that was gambling. In the 18th century, gambling was a huge thing, especially among the rich. There was a vast amount of gambling, and indeed the poor too. And if you gambled on things, and the major gambling sports, perhaps slightly surprisingly, were horse racing, you'd expect that, boxing, you'd expect that, but cricket was a huge gambling game in the 18th century, and bowls was a huge gambling game in the 18th century. And if you're spending lots of money on things, and aristocrats were playing cricket games for the equivalent of £100,000 per afternoon. It was a lot of money involved. You wanted to be able to agree the rules. So that's why they started to agree the rules. And so that was the first phase of the codification of sport, came purely out of gambling.
Yeah, because I wanted to ask you about that. It's a theme that we see through your book. This notion that a lot of fans now feel that our games have been robbed, the sense that the tradition and the history that fans felt this connectivity with their sports locally especially has been taken away by corporations and people eager to make a fast buck. But as you point out, the history is really much more grounded in money making, right back to the sort of roots of these games.
Well, I mean, in terms of the gambling, yes, that was very much the case. In terms of the sport, perhaps most obviously the people think has been taken away from them is soccer. But then they don't understand necessarily where soccer came from. But soccer... it's an extraordinary early history. Soccer was the association football was established by a couple of hundred ex-public schoolboys who founded the FA in 1863. 25 years later, and they were all amateurs and it was entirely southern. 25 years later, only 25 years later, the Football League was started by 12 professional clubs which were being run as businesses, and they were money-making operations even then in whenever that was, 1888.
I mean, so there's a sense then, actually, we're wrong to complain that football's been taken over by money. You know, football was taken over by money 120 years ago.
Football was... taken over is not necessarily the right word, but it was a lot of men who wanted to make money out of it. They also put money into it. The difference, I guess, is that the men then were local businessmen. They were local people who wanted to support their local team. Now, obviously, so many Premiership clubs are owned by foreigners. That's different.
I want to ask more generally about how sport is seen outside of Britain, when so many sports are sort of British creations, if you will, and we still feel quite strongly here that, well, this is our sport, and whether we're good at it or not, it's ours. Do you get a sense that lots of other countries still see Britain as the home for certain sports?
It's very hard to generalise, I think, on that. I think people still recognise the fact that soccer is for instance, a British invention. Rugby is a British invention.
Can we call it football, not soccer?
I was distinguishing between association and union, obviously. And obviously soccer comes out of association. So I often prefer to use the word soccer, but I'll call it football. Well, football can mean so many other things. Football is also rugby. And indeed, initially folk football... was a game which was played for 600 years, and it was played running with the ball in your hand. So soccer is the new invention. Rugby is traditional folk football.
Are you trying to say the Americans are right then when they call football soccer? Because I'm fairly sure they're wrong.
They do it for their own purposes, for obvious reasons, because they have American football, which they say on the front, on the first page of the NFL website, it says that American football is a derivation of the English game of rugby football. That's why they call... that's, if you talk to any American, football is the gridiron game. That's why they call soccer something different.
Let's not fall out of this. Actually, maybe we might have to get another great British institution of arm wrestling going on between the two of you to settle who's right on this. I just wondered, at the moment we're seeing Wimbledon, the sort of the pomp and circumstance. This is another sport that seems to be, from the certainly the international players' view, Wimbledon as the home of the game. Is tennis another sport that has all of its origins here? And again, is the British public right to take pride in it as one of their great contributions to the world of sport?
Yes, absolutely. Tennis itself is a very old game, a game which is called tennis, and we don't quite know where it began. It might well be France, it might be Germany, it's certainly on continental Europe. But it was played here from the 13th century, certainly. That's what we would now call real tennis. It wasn't called real tennis then. The tennis that we now play is an entirely British invention. It was invented by one man who's called Major Walter Clopton Wingfield, who wanted to do something with his... he liked inventing things. He wasn't really a sports person at all, but he loved inventing things. And he wanted to find a game which he could put his... which would put his lawn to use. And so he came up with this format, which isn't that different from the format we have now. And he then called it by the ludicrous name of sphairistiki, which is a Greek word which means game. And he was...
I can't believe that didn't stick.
It was actually called sticky. But he was playing with a couple of future politicians. He was trying to get them interested in it before he actually marketed it. And they said, you can't possibly call it this. But they said, well, what shall I call it? And Arthur Balfour, who became Prime Minister later, came up with the name lawn tennis. And that was what became lawn tennis. And it took off incredibly quickly. He marketed it as a complete kit. You could buy the net and the rackets and the balls. He sold 1,000 in about 6 months. It was sold to nearly every crowned head in Europe. It reached America very quickly. And the All England Croquet Club came across it, rather liked it, and decided to change one of their croquet lawns to a tennis court. And that became very popular. They changed another one. And within 5 years of him launching his new game, they set up the Wimbledon Championships. So we can claim that it's really British.
We can't necessarily claim the Olympics, though, can we? That's which is obviously we're about to enjoy. Yeah, that is always seen as a Greek invention.
We can't claim the Olympics. The modern Olympics was brought to fruition by Pierre de Coubertin, the French aristocrat. Where did he get his inspiration? From British sport. What changed his life was that when he was 12 years old, he was given a copy of Tom Brown's School Days. And he loved the idea, which is expressed in that, of sport being something which is not any good, not only fun, but good for you physically, good for you mentally, and good for you morally. And he became obsessed with trying to introduce the idea of English sports into France initially. And he came over here. He went to rugby school. He came over a couple of times. He went to rugby school. He actually claims to have had a vision in the chapel where Thomas Arnold is buried at rugby school. He also went to see... a man called William Penny Booth, who was a doctor in a little town called Much Wenlock. And he also believed in the idea of sport, and he had, in about 1851, introduced the idea of the Much Wenlock Olympic Games, which went on, still goes on to this day. And de Coubertin went there. Before that, he'd never ever mentioned reviving the Olympic Games. He went there, he saw what Booth was doing. 2 years later, he announced his aim to recreate the Olympic Games. So we can say that we hugely influenced the modern Olympics.
There we are. I think our French and our Greek listeners will be slightly concerned that we're claiming the Olympics for Britain. But I think if we can agree on anything, that's Britain may not be very good at sport, but we're quite good at inventing them and claiming that we invented them.
Absolutely.
Julian Norwich, thank you very much indeed. The book is Can We Have Our Balls Back, Please? How the British Invented Sport and Then Almost Forgot How to Play It. You're listening to Monocle Weekly. There we are. That's sport.
I like sport.
I like sport.
Because
oh,
when you go
yes.
to no, 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 it's
really?
Good. Yeah, because they have these like tents at the back where you can get drinks. That's what I like.
What sport are you going to?
Beers and
tennis.
Cups.
Tennis, Wimbledon.
Yeah?
Yeah, the people who host you, they tend to have hospitality tents. the Olympics. I'm going to the Olympics.
Really? What Olympics tickets do you have?
I've got a lot of Olympic tickets.
Really? Have
yeah.
you?
I've got men's athletics, ladies' gymnastics.
Wow, quite good ones.
Yeah, I've got very
diving?
Good ones. No diving. No. Nothing, unfortunately, that involves swimming pools.
Water sports.
No. Mm. No, certainly none of those. I do... I think that actually there's a few kind of specialist sports that might be nice to see, but I haven't seen any of those. Yeah, I'm going for mainstream.
I've got volleyball tickets, which is almost exciting. And then you realise it's the indoor volleyball, it's the men indoors volleyball, and it's the preliminary round of the men's indoor volleyball.
Do you know what?
Not
I just
really,
want to go.
Yeah.
I just want because I can't imagine I'll ever go to another Olympics.
You want me to go to Rio?
That'd I might right. go to another Olympics. We might tap up our ex-colleague, Saul, who works down there now. He might be able to help us with tickets, I think.
Yeah, he
might. Because we claim to be broadcasting. Anyway, we're going to have something that's not about sport in a moment. We're going to be talking bananas just after this. There are some tales of business in the turbulent last century that span so many topics. They go beyond simple biography and enter myth. Our next guest is an author of a new book about a remarkable man, Sam Zamurri, sometimes known as El Amigo, the Gringo, or simply Zed.
It's a tale that takes in politics, espionage, the creation of the CIA, and the State of Israel, and plays out like a 20th century epic tale with one unlikely theme at the heart of it, bananas. Rich Cohen, author of The Fish That Ate the Whale, joins us on the line now. Rich, welcome to the Monocle Weekly.
Thanks for having me.
Now, Rich, just having read that introduction, this might sound as a very obvious first question, but what drew you to this story?
Well, I went to school in New Orleans, and in New Orleans, Sam Zamurri is like John D. Rockefeller. He's this sort of larger-than-life, somewhat shadowy figure who lived in the biggest house in the city and built this huge fortune on bananas, and you live in that city and you sort of live in his shadow. And but outside New Orleans, he's not really very well known because he kept himself hidden. So to me, it was sort of uncovering this guy that sort of runs like a ribbon through 20th century American history.
And, you know, as you say, he wasn't just a businessman, but obviously, you know, had big connections with the worlds of politics and espionage. Can you give us a bit of a flavor of that?
Well, I mean, what's amazing is he was a Russian immigrant, and he literally fell in love with bananas. Bananas weren't really in the United States, and he started selling overripe bananas that other people were throwing out. And ultimately, he did business in Central America, and in Central America, it was like the rough and tumble in the Wild West. And in Honduras, he got together a group of mercenary soldiers that he recruited in New Orleans, and with 100 guys, basically, he overthrew the government of Honduras in 1911. And that overthrow, which he did with these guys that you'd recognize from Westerns, basically became the model for how the CIA did its work in places like Iran and Guatemala with Sam Zamurri. So he was sort of almost created a template for the Cold War CIA operating with just a few guys abroad.
I mean, I think... interesting to hear more about that a little bit later on, but I'm interested as well when you're writing about a man like this. Obviously, there's so much myth and mystery involved. He's this kind of Rockefeller character. How much did you get a sense that you could kind of separate the myth from the man, and did you get a real sense of who this guy was behind it all?
I do. I think it's a kind of story where you have to keep probing yourself as you go along. Who was this guy? What did he want? Because the myth, now he sort of becomes mythological, and you're right about that, but that even existed at the time. And he very much used this sort of aura he had as this sort of 6'3" Russian Jew from lived in Alabama who went into the jungle with nothing and came out with $1 million to really influence people like Franklin Roosevelt and John Foster Dulles and Alan Dulles. And you really realize the myth wasn't just a thing that we cooked up later, but it was a thing that he himself sort of deployed as one of the weapons in his arsenal. So it is sort of tough to sort of separate because it is kind of who he was in the world, And it's really the kind of life that it seems like people don't live anymore, where you could go away for 2 years into Honduras and it was as if you disappeared, you know? And he lived in Honduras. He lived in the jungle. He spoke Spanish, and he was famous as being a guy who could swear in 5 different languages. And they used to say he spoke English with no accent except when he swore, which was all the time. And those were all things about him in his life, you know, that he was this very colorful, eccentric kind of guy, and that was just part of who he was.
Did he have any political principles at all, or was it all about making money?
Yeah, he was had a lot of political principles, and he was, it might surprise people now, but he was a very big liberal in the United States and a liberal Democrat. He was a big supporter of Franklin Roosevelt and of the New Deal, and he was one of Franklin Roosevelt's advisors, kitchen cabinet, and he was, you know, served on his agricultural commissions, and he was close to a lot of liberal politicians. He was a big enemy of Huey Long, who was the governor of Louisiana, who was sort of the closest the United States had to a European-style dictator in that era. And he gave a lot of money to a lot of very liberal institutions, including The Nation magazine. And he built what many people still consider the best school in Honduras, where there was no tuition, on the condition that you don't go into the banana business. And so he was very political and a creature of the left.
And Rich, why was there so much money to be made from the world of bananas?
Well, it's interesting. Bananas are the biggest selling fruit in the United States, but none of them are grown in the United States. So they're 100% import, and that made, you know, United Fruit, which he ultimately ran, like the first great American global corporation, and they had the largest private navy in the world. So you went from 1876 at the exposition in Philadelphia celebrating the centennial of the United States, they were selling bananas by the slice. That's how rare they were. They did not exist before in the North before you could have steam power. And within a generation, they became the most widely consumed fruit in the country, and not just in the country, but they were huge in the United Kingdom and in Great Britain. And that somebody's making a lot of money. You know, it's like oil or anything else. They were importing all this stuff, and there was suddenly tons and tons of money to be made, and bananas were very cheap. So, and in those countries, they didn't even, a lot of them, it was very corrupt, they didn't even pay taxes, so it was all profit.
His life and story has been described as the kind of epitome of the American dream, this like go-getting entrepreneurship and ability to leave your mark with a bit of ambition. I mean, firstly, would you necessarily agree with that? And secondly, do you think that this is a kind of era lost for America, something that America keeps on harking back to, and the opportunities to kind of take on this grand narrative in the same way that Sansa Murray did has perhaps gone?
Yeah, I mean, it's almost like capitalism without rules. It almost makes you think sometimes of some of the Russian oligarchs, you know? And the idea was there were rules in the United States, but the Supreme Court basically said that these companies weren't bound by any American law outside the United States. It was out of the jurisdiction, even though they were American companies. So it was sort of a free-for-all. And, you know, and not just for the United States, but I think for businessmen from all over the West and Britain, you know, too, which is this idea that there were parts of the world that were sort of unclaimed. And, of course, you know, there's a huge, like a lot of, it's not a victimless thing because people lived in these countries and they sometimes suffered under these companies, United Fruit especially. But I definitely think it was this sort of moment of great expansion and all new sources of wealth and a feeling that there was going to be no limit. And to me, that's why, you know, it really is a symbol of kind of, Zamuri becomes the American dream in the shape of a single life. Because he sort of really was the equivalent of a guy who starts pumping gas, and 20 years later he owns ExxonMobil. I mean, he took over, and the idea that there was never going to be any limit, and there was just going to be money to be made forever in these other countries.
Rich Cohen, author of The Fish That Ate the Whale, The Life and Times of America's Banana King, thank you very much indeed for joining us on The Monocle Weekly. The book is out now. It's published by Jonathan Cape. You're listening to The Weekly. We're back right after this.
We're going to be talking cinema in a little while. But first, it's time for a song. This is Esperanza Spalding with Radio Song.
That was Esperanza Spalding with Radio Song. In the battle against piracy and as a lure to entice cinema-goers out of their homes and into cinemas, studios, distributors and filmmakers are turning to ever-increasingly spectacular methods of bringing an intense cinema experience to film lovers.
Around the world, an ever-increasing number of films are being made and screened in IMAX in over 500 cinemas worldwide now, and with the anticipated Dark Knight film amongst them. Joining us on the line now to discuss this is Andrew Cripps, president of IMAX EMEA. Andrew, welcome to the Monocle Weekly.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
Thank you. First of all, just to kind of clear up what we're talking about here, IMAX isn't synonymous with 3D, is it? What makes IMAX special?
IMAX is a big screen experience, great sound. I think when someone walks into an IMAX theater, they're struck by the size of the screen and the fantastic audio. Some of our big films have been in 3D, some are in 2D. The upcoming Dark Knight is in 2D. The Amazing Spider-Man at the moment in cinemas is in 3D, so we play both.
And I mean, there's a lot of discussion in the kind of film press about what IMAX can add to a film experience and sometimes what it can detract as well. Are you aware of which formats you think are particularly successful when used in IMAX? And do you, as a company, have an opinion on which kind of genres should perhaps be left alone?
I think our core audience is the fanboy audience. Now, obviously, you know, it can expand out from that. But if you look at films like, you know, we've been incredibly successful this year with films like The Avengers, The Amazing Spider-Man. We do attract a key core fanboy demographic. So we start from there and, you know, hopefully the film expands and broadens into other age demographics.
Do you worry that, you know, IMAX was considered the future maybe 10 years ago, but then other things like 3D have come along? Do you worry that IMAX might just be the Betamax of the 21st century?
No, not at all. I think, I think we're an affordable luxury for people. I think in trying economic times, people are looking for an escape from the home. I think we provide that. And I think increasingly, as the home entertainment experience gets better and better, the cinema experience also has to evolve and get better and better. And I think IMAX provides that experience to people.
Are you tapping in as well? I mean, we've seen across different sectors, different industries, that kind of there's been a rise in the experiential, and I think it's certainly come off the back of this a slight disillusionment with the digital moment, that people actually now what they really want to pay for is things where they leave, you know, they can share it with friends, they leave having a sense that they've really experienced something. Is that an area that you're consciously trying to tap into with your kind of business strategy?
Yeah, we do tap into it. I think if you monitor the social network platforms, you know, if you look at Facebook and Twitter and places like that, when a movie comes out in IMAX, you know, the number of people talking about it, you know, goes up exponentially. So, you know, it's certainly part of our marketing strategy, and it's certainly something that works well for us because our key demographic, you know, use social media extensively.
But it's still quite a lot of money for filmmakers to ensure that their film is, if you like, IMAX friendly. Do you worry that it puts off a lot of people from actually sort of making use of the technology?
No, I think we're offered far more films than we can actually play in the IMAX network. So for every film that we do, we're offered four or five other movies. You know, I think certain filmmakers certainly have embraced the technology. They love the technology and they want to see their movies, you know, in the biggest possible format, and that's IMAX.
Andrew Cripps, president of IMAX EMEA, thank you very much for joining us on the Monocle Weekly. You're listening to The Weekly here on Monocle 24.
Well, that was interesting. Do you know what a fanboy is?
I thought that was you, isn't it? Are you not a fanboy?
I've never heard that phrase before. It seems to be a whole demographic, fanboys.
I imagine it's the people that attend Comic-Con and those kind of big trade fairs. It's people who love comics. I kind of understood what you meant.
I've actually seen fanboys at Monocle summer parties.
There's, can I just say...
They're monoboys.
They're boys with fans, with Monocle-branded fans.
What's that shop that's on Shaftesbury Avenue that's all comics and fan stuff? Forbidden Planet.
Yes, Forbidden Planet, yes.
That is like a magnet for all the people you're most scared of in society. It really is.
All the people you're most scared of in society.
It's like those Warhammer gaming shops as well. Yeah,
I'm a bit scared about the people who actually like those things.
But obviously, they're spending on cinema.
Yes, but they do like. Yeah, they like to be in the dark where no one can see them. The lights are off. But then they can. Then they think they're making friends. That's where fanboys go. It seems. Well, that was quite a nice show. I learned something about sport.
Yes, we learned about bananas. Waiting and procrastination. We learned that my way of filing copy is actually quite professional and that you should wait until the very last moment.
And I like the idea that bananas were so expensive you bought them by the slice.
Yeah.
That must have been good.
Elite.
Now, you see, in our office, it's a banana office, isn't it? Because we get free fruit here in the morning.
Not
pretty much. I mean, you can go to the kitchen, there's fruit and you can have it.
And apples. Can't leave out the others.
Yes.
The occasional tangerine.
But the problem with the bananas is sometimes a little bit too green.
Yes.
But instead of waiting,
people eat them.
Yeah. And so then you're like, oh, do I take one and wait for it to ripen? Or do I?
I can't bear
it. Do you know why the banana is the most popular fruit?
Is this a real reason?
Yeah, it's a real reason.
Go on.
It's because it's easy to peel and it's got no seeds. So people don't like, actually, people are put off eating things like cherries because they don't know what to do with the stones and they don't like getting a stone in their mouth. That people don't like eating apples because there are actually people who are scared of apple cores, it seems.
Really?
Because
they've got arsenic in them.
I have to keep a very solid perimeter between myself and the apple core. So I waste a lot of apple. My nightmare is breaking through to a core.
So even at least a centimetre. Everyone's nightmare.
Well, I think they should make apples coreless and cherries stoneless, and then people would eat those as well. But yeah, that's why people like a banana, because there's nothing.
They'd be genetically modified though, then.
I don't mind that.
Really?
Then you get into that whole murky category of, is it, because fruits have to have seeds. Bananas do in fact have seeds. They're just tiny, those little grey specks.
The black thing at the end.
Ooh.
That's not nice, is it?
No, that would be you're listening to Nature Hour here on Morgan 24.
You're the fruitarians.
It's a bunch of fruit. And from one bunch of fruit to another. On that note. Anyway, I think we should wrap up this Monocle Weekly, which has been a fine fest of intellect, stamina, and bananas, and the oddball. That's all for this week's episode of the Monocle Weekly, which was produced by Paul Noble. We're going to play you out with This Sweet Love by James Yule. But for now, from all of us here, it's goodbye from me, Andrew Tuck.
From me, Steve Bloomfield.
And from me, Jonathan Openshaw. Goodbye.